Welcome everyone to the Pop Culture Podcast by Fantastic Geek. My name is Matt, and joining me as always is Pete. Hello, Pete.
Hello, Matt. Hello, everybody. Here today to talk to you about Justice League, the big DC Extended Universe team-up film. But first, Matt, a couple of pieces of housekeeping.
Indeed, Pete. Simultaneous to this, we will be releasing our podcast review for The Punisher, episode 102, tomorrow. That's November 20th, if you're listening in the future. And that'll, of course, continue to roll along at a fairly decent clip. Also, Pete, because the TV and movie gods are kind to us, the old ones and the new, even old Shazam there, but we'll get to him later on, we will be podcasting Runaways, episode 101, on Tuesday. That's when that episode and the next two hit Hulu. And then, of course, December 1st, the Mothership returns, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. And, Pete, all these pop culture gods just want to make sure that we aren't, that we don't have too much free time in this busy holiday season.
It's all good. Certainly appreciate this wealth of riches, particularly at a festive time of year.
Well, Pete, with that, let's talk the box office results for Justice League. And certainly the estimates were rolling in preliminarily as early as Friday midday as people were extrapolating the Thursday night previews. But the tallies basically being all but in at this point as we record, an estimated $96 million earned in these United States over the 3 days. And of course, because it's Hollywood, that's the 3 days plus all those shows Thursday night. Hollywood accounting, not my accounting. This is $2 million short of the last DCEU movie, if not more than that, depending on how the final money comes in. And Wonder Woman was at about $103 million. So not a good picture there. Internationally, it's made $185 million. So I'm sure there are many people who would say, hey, clearly that means the movie has made money. Well, it cost a reported $300 million. It made $281 this weekend, but of course, as always, A, these numbers do not include the cost of advertising, and B, theaters take a 50% cut. So this is, I dare say, this is a dire financial situation for this movie.
I want to go back, Matt. Let's go back 5-6 years ago. And we're going to place ourselves in a Warner Brothers executive suite as they are dreaming of their team-up film of Batman and Superman and Wonder Woman and the other not as iconic but no less included members of the Justice League. Do we really think these are the results they thought about? That a movie that is under 2 hours, which we can really argue underweight for the amount of iconic characters in it, to produce less than $100 million in a weekend. And Matt, I've not even brought up any comparison at this point. This is nothing less than an absolute step in the wrong direction in so many different ways, but we will point first to the financial. And this is not going to have legs like Wonder Woman, pun intended, because based on that opening weekend, so many other people got the word it's good. It's okay, or meh, or it didn't destroy my childhood, but it was good. And that film had, again, not pun intended here, legs. Justice League, can we really see people going to see this again who are not masochists?
Well, courtesy of the wonderful people at boxofficemojo.com, I can tell you Wonder Woman had a 43% drop first weekend to the next weekend. The other movies in this league, Man of Steel, Batman v Superman, Suicide Squad, were all over 60%. So,
and this will be up in that area. You can book that now.
So again, if you enjoyed the movie, we're not telling you shouldn't have enjoyed the movie. We're going to get into plot and character and setting and theme and all that in a moment. But just purely from the finances, this is an incredibly negative picture. It's the lowest opening weekend of the five films. But it's supposed to be the capper of these five.
This should be a celebration, Matt. This should be, we've earned it. They're all here. And it's just not, it doesn't come across that way on the screen. It's certainly not coming across that way with the fans. And I think the fans of these characters expect and demand better. And I think that's what's going to lead to some kind of radical change, that this cannot continue. And these results tomorrow and how they'll be greeted in Hollywood, I think will be demonstrative.
As I've said many times on the Pop Culture Podcast, although perhaps not recently, I mean, from where I sit, I can see my copy of Man of Steel number one from 1986 when they rebooted the DC universe. At the time, it was the first reboot. I hold the character of Superman very near and dear to my heart. And the fact that this is the 25th anniversary of the Death of Superman storyline, which was incredible, the fact that they stuck with it, with him being dead for as long as they did, I believe all four of the titles about a year after it, you know, they did the whole funeral bit and all that. For about 2 months, all four titles simply went dark. They carried on this notion that they had simply canceled the character. And then slowly the return, and there was the reign of the Superman, and the just wonderful, wonderful, rich storylines. It was through the lens of that, through the lens of my teenage childhood, that they kind of pressed fast forward on a lot of that and got us to Justice League in this story here.
Well, I think that the straits creatively that they've put themselves in led to the rush of that beyond the impatience. Remember, we went to team up in movie two with Batman v Superman. But obviously based on the critical reaction to that, and I'll never forget the press visit for Justice League. They invited anybody pretty much that they could get there, who they had watch a scene of Ben Affleck and Ezra Miller in their characters. And it was, we got jokes now. And you look at the final product, and regardless of tone, Matt, regardless of tone, and yes, this is lighter and it's nowhere near as dark as the, shall we say, the tire sledgehammering scene in Batman v Superman, which was gratuitous, but it still misses the mark.
Well, Pete, let's talk about the 800-pound gorilla in the room, the gorilla grodd, if you will, Henry Cavill's digital upper lip, which I was going to say was as expected. It was worse than I expected in that opening scene, a scene which is ostensibly shot on a, you know, on a camera phone or a camcorder. So it allows for a degraded visual image because it's this kind of homemade, can we talk to you for our podcast, says the boys recording video, because that's how that's done. But it looked like plastic on there. It looked like silly putty.
I was unaware of this thing until, I guess, three and a half weeks ago when you brought it up in passing. And I said, wait, what? Now, you mentioned your Superman cred before, and I think yours is a little bit more than mine. However, being older, I go back further with the character. I go back to the 1978 You Will Believe a Man Can Fly. Christopher Reeve is my Superman. I remember vividly Superman 2 in a theater. And I would argue the greatest Superman film of all time that we're still trying to get back to. Not as big a Batman fan, but a Batman fan, I think, along the lines of a general audience. And I loved the Wonder Woman movie, with one small exception, that being the handoff in the beginning with Bruce Wayne sending her the picture so she can have a flashback, because narratively there's no other way for her to think about her past. That being said, this digital upper lip distracted me for the entire film that he was on screen. I was constantly looking, is this real lip or is this digital lip? This is the new Sue Storm wig.
I didn't want to spend the rest of the movie watching his upper lip whenever Superman was on screen, because though Christopher Reeve is my Superman and though Tom Welling is my Clark Kent, there's nothing wrong at all with Henry Cavill's performance as Superman and Clark Kent. He brings the appropriate purity. He brings the appropriate strength. I mean, he's perfect. He's perfect for it. It's just that Christopher Reeve is better and Tom Welling is better. But Henry Cavill as the guy we have now, I mean, it really is, in my mind, an apples and oranges kind of thing. It really is.
I don't think there's been a poorly cast Superman. I don't think we can look back. It's not as if there's a Clooney in the pile, okay, and say what you want there, possibly the most successful actor to play that role, but it's the decisions they're making with him, and the decision of, well, we got to bring him back, and he's shooting this other movie, and he's got a mustache, and he can't shave the mustache, and where is the fortitude to say, okay, that's gonna look goofy, we're gonna delay. If this shot is worth it, if these decisions that we have to do are truly going to impact it, and what's the end takeaway of that scene? He's asked what he likes about Earth, and he doesn't answer.
I'll do you one better, Pete. How was that a reshoot thing? Like, that's a great way to – you're all psyched up. It's the team-up movie, and you need to remind the audience that, you know, when last they visited – the DCEU, it was Wonder Woman in flashback. The time they did it before that, it was Suicide Squad, which is far from perfect, but is asking a whole lot of zany fun from it. But the point being, we now need to think back 1, 2, 3 movies ago to Death of Superman, Bring the Energy Down. It's a perfect, perfect addition at the beginning to kind of properly ground things. It indeed almost echoes of the first Guardians movie, where you say, who's ready for some comic book and space fun? But first, mom's dead. Title card, take a deep breath. Now we're going to have fun, but first you have to eat your vegetables. This is what came before this? What narratively was this other than children admiring Superman, who sees the best in all of us? The best in, you know, originally the best in this country.
And can't answer. And can't answer. I thought he was going to say, my mind said it. You kids, you're the greatest thing. Protecting you, saving our future. Something. Non-answer. Boom. Let's watch the movie.
So, yeah. So I mean, I guess that brings us to a lot of these changes were changes that, I suppose all involved felt needed to be made, and certainly much has been made of the added levity and humor that Joss Whedon brought. I would argue that there are whole scenes, certainly in my mind, there were scenes where I said, all right, this whole series of jokes, this is a Joss Whedon reshoot. Oh, this slow-mo action scene, this is definitely a Zack Snyder, you know, from the script, directed by him kind of moment. And I guess that's a way indirectly to take a moment to indeed acknowledge the tragedy that befell the Snyders and had them step away from this project.
Yeah. And the moment that we heard that story, it's amazing that it was kept as quiet as it was until April of this year, when it was announced that their daughter had committed suicide and that the executive team at Warner Brothers came to them and said, okay, you have gone through a terrible thing and we have a plan in place and you're going to go tend to matters. Not that they hadn't dealt with it, but just that they hadn't taken the time off. They were deep in the post-production of this film, that they needed time, that they needed space, and 16-hour days doing superhero movie stuff is really not what should be done at a time when that happens. And maybe they were burying themselves in their work too, to you know, prevent them from dealing with it right away. That would be a natural human reaction as well. That being said, I think that's become part of the narrative of the film, and it changed the staffing of this film. I was unable to do what you talked about other than, okay, I think Whedon did this scene. I think Snyder did this action scene, which is super simplistic. I didn't mark big tonal shifts as I feared with this film, so I think I have to consider that a win within this.
I certainly would agree that as a final product, as an authored work, my own little sense of, hey, I attribute everything funny to Joss Whedon and everything slow motion to Zack Snyder. I don't think that, or certainly I was not trying to suggest that I really genuinely could get a sense of two different authors with differing voices. You want to throw some more humor in there? You're going to do so largely by use of humorous characters. I mean, shades of Ant-Man in Captain America Civil War, where Ant-Man's humor is a tonal shift from the seriousness that's going on. However, it works. So I think that if they're using that, I don't want to say as a template even, but if that is an analogy, I think that it's acceptable to have that. And I'm not literally saying all the funnies go to Joss Whedon. I felt like it was a cohesive narrative piece, one different from the past, but clearly the audience was asking for something different, and clearly, hopefully, the desire is to do something different. And I guess, Pete, let's start to dig into that narrative journey there. We have Batman, we have Bruce Wayne looking to build the team. We know from the prior films he's reached out to Wonder Woman, so she's already on board. And then first up, we see him interacting with Aquaman.
With regard to Ben Affleck's Batman, here in his third film, he's the only one who shows up in Suicide Squad, and he has a couple scenes. We know that Affleck has already flaked on writing the Batman solo film. He has now bounced on directing it. Reportedly, Matt, the quote is, he is looking for a cool way out of playing the character. And I think that's my biggest issue with this film. They say that you should be able to look at any film and answer objectively the question, whose story is this? And in team-ups, admittedly, it can be difficult to do that. But I'd have to say, just like Batman v Superman, this is his film. And he seems so checked out of it. He just does not, even with the funnies now, even with the jokes, where you talk to fish, It does not seem like he's invested at all. And again, there's a guy who's had some pretty serious things go on off screen that we can certainly as human beings understand. But, you know, are these decisions the best possible decisions? Are there ways with properties this important rather than we got to hit a date? The cautionary tale is the story of Bret Easton Ellis overhearing two Warner Brothers executives talk about the problems with the Batman script. And it's, well, this is going to trigger delay. The other one says, well, what's the difference between $800 million and $1.5 billion? That's how they at Warner Brothers right now view these characters. It is an actuarial table rather than this is a plan.
And for people doing the math and saying, well, it's a whole heck of a lot of difference. Well, after theaters take their cut, it's a $300 million difference. How much are you spending on your delayed reshoot? How much of that $300 million potential profit difference to make the thing better? How much do you put in to make it better? And at which point do you go, we're not going to spend $75 million to make another $100 million. Things are fine where they're at. I mean, you mentioned Affleck and what seems to be a slightly unengaged performance here. Genuinely, Pete, and you and I have not spoken much about this movie since we saw it. Genuinely, as we were watching it, I had pop into my head his introduction in Shakespeare in Love, where it's some line where it's like, what is the play and what part shall
we
be playing?
The Admiral's men have returned.
And it's just this, it's this charismatic, he's this charismatic sponge that quite frankly, in those scenes, and 100% appropriately, in those scenes, he has the bombastic actor. He outshines all the other, his character outshines all the other characters, and quite frankly, his performance outshines all the other actors' performances in the scenes he's in. I'm not saying he's the best one in the movie because little is asked of him dramatically. It's more kind of broadly comedic, but
I go back to those early Afflecks, that Armageddon. Okay. And granted, he had been in some Kevin Smith stuff and he did some other stuff, and Good Will Hunting, those three films there and that early to mid Affleck swagger. And yeah, it's 15, 18, 20 years ago. I get it. But you're playing Bruce Wayne, man. You're playing Batman. And he gives you the gravelly voice, but you want some investiture. And there's very little.
There even were some scenes later in the movie. And I was saying to myself, I don't want to forget what they're talking about here, but there's a scene where it's him. It's him and Wonder Woman when they're in the Batcave, the two of them kind of sparring slightly. This is somewhere in the middle of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like both of them were just not into it. And I remember just thinking to myself, these two people are better than this scene. And I don't care which director is directing. Everybody, you, me, everybody listening, we have our worst day at work. Or we have the least productive hour of the day. It's up to the director to say, cut. Give me another take. Hey guys, listen, I need some more energy here, or, you know, pretend this or whatever it is. It's the director's job to direct more out of them than the editor to pick the best take. So there is just kind of this strain through it. And again, it's somewhat tender territory because if it's a Joss Whedon scene, well, there are reasons why, you know, maybe he was up against the clock. If it's a Zack Snyder scene, I'm certainly not going to castigate the guy for, depending on when this was shot in relation to tragedy in his personal life, but to separate
and
ourselves.
Who knows the tale, how long that led up to that culminating event. There could have been further, you know, issues in his personal life working towards that. So again, full sensitivity to the guy. Nobody wanted to hear that story. And I think almost universally, I did see some jerks making light of that. But almost universally, people stepped back and said, wow, you've made some movies that have disappointed some people. You've made some movies that have made some people pretty happy. I really liked 300. I even liked the one with in the insane asylum where the girls, you know, had swords and stuff that I can't even remember. And that's what I call that movie. And I like bits and pieces of that. But, you know, he's had some creative missteps since then, but yeah, just like make the better call and get the best out of these people. A lot of these other movies, and Matt, I am not going to compare by name in this podcast, and we are certainly conscious of our bias, but you don't feel like that happens elsewhere. And you feel for some reason it happens in Warner Brothers. You have to wonder, is this a Snyder issue or is this a leadership problem with Warner Brothers?
To me, it comes back to a leadership issue because it's the same kind of movie to a certain degree, or the fact that these, with the exception of Wonder Woman, the fact that these movies, there continues to be this frantic reshoot stuff at the end. Now, of course, all movies have reshoots, but just tonal shifts that you see in Suicide Squad, which I think Suicide Squad is made up of really entertaining parts, but you put it all together and you say, why didn't you do the Joker Harley movie? Why didn't you do, you know, why did you give so little to some of the characters on the squad? And well, you know, that's, you can go back and listen to our Suicide Squad podcast, but I do wonder what's going on there that Zack Snyder's boss, or Zack Snyder's boss's boss, you know, there's a head of DC Films, Jeff Johns, I believe is the name.
Yes.
what's his role in all of this? And then if his role is to be accidentally stepping into something great with Wonder Woman, but there are these concerns with the other four, well, then what's his boss's boss? What's the head of Warner Brothers saying with all of this? And it's just, so to me, it is a leadership issue, because at the end of the day, it shouldn't be this difficult to have a fun team-up movie. You want to say, well, it's difficult to find the right tonal shift for Wonder Woman, lady who fights in a one-piece bathing suit and a sword back in time. I don't know how you make that. All right, that's a little bit more challenging than getting the crew together, and you just kind of need to hit the high notes with each of these characters to make you feel good, and then you can go in the separate movies and do, oh man, Cyborg looking at the nature of man, and Aquaman looking at environmental issues, and the Flash movie, you know, how's he able to socially integrate with people? But it shouldn't be this tough.
It shouldn't. Given that Snyder was connected with the Wonder Woman script, I would have to concur that it's a leadership issue. They have had some success, and she's the bright point. I just think we have to look at what's on screen of Gal Gadot in Justice League and acknowledge the character is far better in Patty Jenkins' hands than anybody else.
Good news, Pete. Our concerns that Wonder Woman was going to be a fourth line supporting player in Justice League, it was not that. I would say she was junior only to Batman in this. Obviously, there are some story moments which become very Superman-centric, but I think that was more the story doing what it had to do, and not, you know, some plot to undermine Wonder Woman and feminists and powerful women everywhere. So she had the number two spot overall, and I think the character was very, very well executed, but there was just a little sparkle missing, which, to be fair, I think in whether it's this, whether it's Avengers, you do lose some of that ability to spend time with each character. So I guess there's the good news, Pete. The good news is we had a great presentation of Wonder Woman in this film.
And then there's Aquaman, which, if you've seen any of the promotional stuff, you know how it's going to go. And I can't even call Jason Momoa's character Aquaman. I call him Catchphrase.
Here's where I wonder how much bias did I have coming into it. I was very confused. Frankly, I was a little put off by the fact that the character did not have an accent. Now, I don't think that Arthur Curry in the comics has an accent. So how much of that is me saying, wow, he is most famous for the super iconic character of Drogo from Game of Thrones. So how much of that is me expecting him to talk like this? And when he's given the ability to speak as Jason Momoa does, it's a little bit of like a Hawaiian bro thing, but otherwise, you know, just a standard non-regional American accent. That kind of took me out of it. So Pete, tell me, is that my fault for expecting Drogo with a trident that has two extra spikes? Or, I don't know, should this presentation of guy who lives under the sea, should he speak with some sort of strange Mer accent?
I think it was as it should be presented. They shouldn't have done anything from an ethnic accent standpoint. Yes, Khal Drogo being his most famous role to date. And they've, in addition to all the other baggage of the film, they've been handicapped in the last month to 6 weeks. A clip of him from 2011 on a press tour, actually San Diego Comic-Con with Game of Thrones, where he joked about the perk of his job being to rape young actresses on the show. And that surfaced in the last couple weeks, and that the Affleck groping accusation and subsequent video that surfaced from MTV a decade and a half ago. So those are real world things, again, intruding into our fictional thing. I dig Momoa's energy, and I certainly appreciate the attempt that he gave. But man, the lines that they gave him, yeah, my man. Like, no. Give me that energy, but give me something a little fresher and authentic.
I'll just mention as an aside, I was glad that they had in Momoa somebody who has primo physique like you and I do, Pete. Somebody, you know, the tats everywhere. It made me feel really included that just like a totally jacked, long-haired, bearded guy like him, like us, could finally be represented on screen. Tongue firmly in cheek, dear listeners.
His best scene is when he sits on the lasso of truth. And that's where I think they achieved what the character can and should be going forward. Now, you can't constantly make the guy sit on Wonder Woman's lasso. So find other ways to get that performance and that character there when you're going to do it. We go to all these things because we want to. We go to these things because people want to hear what we think of them, and we'll be at Aquaman that first weekend. And I hope we get closer to that portrayal of the character then.
Next up is The Flash, who, of course, we had seen a little snippet of in Batman v Superman. And since then, I've become more aware of Ezra Miller, particularly his really pathos-driven role in Fantastic Beasts. I have zero complaints about him here. I had no idea that they were going to paint him as, at the very least, somewhat socially awkward, perhaps a little hint of being on the spectrum. If he was your original script or your rewrite script infusion of humor, I think he's a great character to do it, in part because he moves fast, which means he can think fast, which means he is going to be out of sync with everybody a little bit. So play into that, make him be a source of comedy, make him be a source of, frankly, some confusion. And I mean that in the best sense. Since he's younger, you're presenting him as not yet working as the crime lab guy, so kind of early in his mythos. He's able to be less mature. He's not the king of Atlantis. He's not, you know, the ageless Wonder Woman. He's not Batman 20 years into being the Bat. Even the suit, where I was a little like, all right, everything doesn't need to be Zack Snydered up here with 5-point pitchforks and really weird, pointy, angular suits. Once we got into the movie, that's a cool suit. I don't know where it came from. I don't know why he built it. They made reference to frictionless this and that, the other. It was cool. The whole character was cool.
He is effervescent in this film. He keeps it light. He gets the majority of the laughs. That being said, Matt, they have a perfectly seasonable, usable Flash already, DC does, on TV. And say what you want about Batman v Superman, and he's barely in it. He's checked. He delivers the dream, maybe a fast forward flashback thing. Still not quite clear, nor has any of it ever been explained what happened there. But, you know, we see the video of him, and then he interacts briefly with Bruce Wayne, and that was that. And clearly, that's all that film could take because it was an overstuffed mess. But here, he's the best part. And you just wonder, though, why they wouldn't reach to bring the Flash from TV. Of all these other characters that don't exist on TV, you know, we've got Arrow, we've got Flash, we've got Supergirl now, all on the WB, all on the old WB, the CW. And much has been made about their disconnected TV to film universe. But why, with their most popular property in The Flash, which you've watched a little of, I watched some of the pilot, it's just not capturing my fancy, but I can absolutely respect how much people gravitate to the point where you were telling me about other people's Justice Leagues.
Yeah, there was a tweet that showed Arrow. I think it was from, and pardon me, I regret, dear listener, that I'm just simply not into the CW DC shows.
We watched Supergirl over CBS. You know, it just didn't pull us over there. And I think some of the creative decisions there. But I think we both liked a lot of things about that first season.
Yeah, so there was this picture that was from some sort of alternate timeline thing because the logos were different. But it was essentially, aside from the alternate thing, it was Arrow, it was one of the alternate Flashes, the guy in the yellow suit, and then Supergirl. And somebody had said, "My Justice League." And though I'm not an active viewer of those shows, I don't understand how it is that with the fan interaction that those actors have, and they're at conventions all the time. The guy that plays Arrow has started his own, if not convention company, then like his own convention agent company, because how conventions work is so foreign to the average Hollywood agent. So he's in on it, interacting with the fans, really understanding the fan situation. Fans who could have maybe shown up more if they were excited about a Justice League movie.
Right.
How it is that there's all this great stuff going on. And this even goes back to the Smallville days when Smallville was season 2, 3, 4 and fantastic. And there were discussions of what became the Brandon Routh Superman movie. It would have been, how amazing would it have been to take this guy who already was in the role and do some sort of, you know, from TV to the movies, back to TV thing, figure out a way to pay him, figure out a way to pay everybody. It only could have boosted the TV end. You would have had a guy who already had a fan audience built in. So that's the argument for Tom Welling's Smallville 10, 12, 15 years ago. Why aren't they doing that now with this?
And it seems to be the universal refrain of these films. They can't seem to get you the best version of those characters on screen. Whether it's, we already have one and a lot of people like him and he's really popular. Nah, you know what? We're going to have a film-only Flash. And it's not for a lack of trying. I appreciated what they did with the Billy Crudup father character and the scenes there in the prison and the motivation to, you know, get a job and boom, he gets recruited by Bruce Wayne and, you know, he supplies the laughs. But I just think had they gone in that other direction, they had something ready made that would bring people, as you mentioned, who are already big fans to this. And I really don't think they got a lot of them this weekend. Not as many as they could have.
Let's talk about Cyborg. I think a really wise way to add some extra pathos into the story. Yes, we've just been arguing for the laughs, but you get somebody who has this, you know, really compelling man versus machine story. You get diversity in there. None of it is, I was going to say forced. I mean, if you want to change the race in a character, I could kind of care less. But the fact that Cyborg is already a character of color, you kind of don't need to change the character. You just say, boom, Cyborg is now in Justice League. It's kind of win-win. I found him to be a tad dour overall. However, given his how that's his, you know, he's essentially kind of Hamlet, but he's not mourning the loss of his father. He's mourning the loss of himself.
Right.
And if that's the route you want to go with, I dug the route, even though I kind of would have preferred another yuck yuck character, but they made a choice. They went for it. I have no complaints.
You're right about the pathos, and I think back to his introduction in Batman v Superman, the one that I think I got the most interested in, like, all right, what's this guy's story of needing to come into contact with the mother box to stay alive, you know, his grief-stricken father and everything there. And we learn a little bit more. There was an explosion, the mom died, and although not a lot of particulars. But I know some people made an issue of Cyborg being one of the founding members of the Justice League when that's not the original story. I'm fine with that. I'm definitely fine with that in the context of 2017 and a commitment to diversity and being able to include people of all different looks, creeds, et cetera, et cetera. I like the joke Flash had made earlier that could reference inclusion as well. I just think the dour nature, like you mentioned, really kind of overpowered it. And of any of them, I'd say he was a 1A for me to Flash. It's the design of the character that I think where he really falls short. As I can't take credit for it, somebody else has said it's broke ass Iron Man with really bad CGI.
Well, concerning his inclusion in the Justice League, I mean, if he was merely promoted to that role for this movie, and neither you nor I have a complaint for it, complaint with it, for whatever it's worth, Cyborg was established as a founding member of the Justice League in 2011 with the New 52, and then the reboot that wrapped up New 52, which was DC Rebirth, same thing. So,
which seems to really be their big template for this, apart from some of the bigger arcs, Death of Superman, and, you know, possibly the homages with Affleck to Batman, The Dark Knight Returns. So that's all fine. Again, man, get a better suit. I liked it when you had him in the sweatshirt. I liked it when they went that, the full on, and they even give him a better body at the end of the movie. So is it we're gonna track this up to lousy CGI, or we gave you inferior CGI so that at the end of the movie we can give you better CGI, and it seems like an improvement.
I did like what caught my eye is as the suit continues to evolve, it kind of reached a point where particularly around the hips where it was like unusually narrow, like they were playing with more than, hey, he's wearing a motion capture suit and we're gonna use a computer to paint over that with the various parts. Like I think they started to do things that the human body couldn't do in terms of shape, which, not for nothing, if you're going to CG the majority of the guy's body, do something interesting. So maybe that's part of it too. And maybe there's this whole arc that wasn't as obvious as they had intended, or that was the obviousness of which was cut away through the reshoot and the re-edit process. But
yeah. I hope that a lot of that story gets retold in the Cyborg, you know, regular scheduled film, if that even comes to pass at this point. I think a lot is going to be up in the air in light of how this movie did this weekend. But Matt, you build a team to fight a threat, right?
Absolutely you do, Pete. Tell us about the big threat here of Steppenwolf.
Well, Steppenwolf, right? Yeah, Steppenwolf. Is that again who they imagined that, hey, we're going to get all six of these iconic heroes together and they're going to battle, and one of them says, oh, that one that killed Superman 20 years ago. No, because we've already done that. And it was real lousy CGI. And again, it was not carried off well. Oh, they're going to battle the one with the funny symbol, right? You know, Darkseid. No, we won't have done that yet. We won't. We're building to that.
I was flabbergasted.
Fight. Oh, they're going to fight Steppenwolf. Who?
Pete, I was flabbergasted. I was so much expecting from Batman v Superman, particularly the pace that they are choosing to do, which is not to write a script in 2010 for Avengers in 2012, was it? Which first gives us Thanos, and to really play that out and really stretch that out. If the decision is we want to speed things up a little bit relative to Marvel's pace, okay, that's cool. I was completely ready for Darkseid to show up. Darkseid is a great character from the comics, somebody who I remember fondly as kind of this big bad that in the comics I read, they're kind of tiptoeing around him, and there's all that threat to him. And then when it wasn't, and when it was a certain point where, oh no, it's not like Steppenwolf is even going to be the first half bad guy or the harbinger of doom, and then Darkseid shows up, we don't even get the Fantastic Four, Silver Surfer kind of Galactus, you know, kind of reference, like, oh, you see his shape in the cloud, to get none of Darkseid and Steppenwolf is it? That was a disappointment.
There was some Darkseid stuff that was filmed that was apparently cut. And, you know, I think one of the issues with this film that's been an issue with all the DC Extended Universe films, the idea of larger cuts now available on Blu-ray and DVD, so we can make up the back end that we're still trying to do 3 months, 4 months, 6 months down the road, whatever it is, it'll show up there. But in Ciaran Hinds, who they got from Game of Thrones, who played Mance Rayder, we need Darth Vader, not Mance Rayder. to unite these six iconic heroes, and it just was not happening.
Yeah, it was a curious decision for a baddie whose motivation is, I want to destroy the world because the last time I tried to destroy the world, you beat me. Like, that's it? It lacks the complexity of, and, you know, I hate to go back and compare it to Loki, but you know what? Everybody's comparing the failure of this movie financially and critically to the Marvel stuff, so be it. Loki, who is driven by his greed, and there's scene after scene after scene in the first Thor movie where Loki's presence for that story is not necessary, but he's there in a very passive way to build up that sense of being second best and his sense of wanting revenge and all that, which feeds into the first Avengers movie. For Ultron, not my favorite Marvel movie by far, but in Age of Ultron, his motivation as, you know, Pinocchio with strings cut and I can do it better than humans can and all of that, that's really compelling and interesting. If not, you know, again, there's less than perfect stuff in that film. And then, of course, we've been building to Thanos for the better part of this decade. To just have this guy who, like, he's angry because he's angry that he didn't get his ice cream last time, so now he wants his ice cream this time. Okay. And by the way, you know, it's the series of three things that you need to do, and it's the three boxes. It was a little underwhelming.
There are hints and scenes in expanded versions of other films to this point that point towards him. I just don't care to seek them out, and they didn't make it a thing that I need to seek them out, because Steppenwolf sucked as a villain. He really, really did. And okay, they tried to get you with a little bit of, well, we're going to tease out a bad Superman, a kind of the idea of the rise of the Supermen, but, you know, clearly rushed, not as good, not even as a Superman 3, you know, 5 o'clock shadow Superman battling Clark Kent in a junkyard. As awful as that is, I still look back at that with some kind of infatuation instead of what we got.
Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Man's Chest came out 11 years ago. Davy Jones was done with motion capture and the actor's eyes were real. Bill Nye's eyes were real.
It's a tremendous effect. It still holds up. Flawlessly. I have very fond memories of, and I own, you know, that trilogy. I have very fond memories of that second film in particular. It's their Empire Strikes Back. And that is a wonderful, wonderful villain. And yeah, you could do that. And I think, again, look at the pantheon of other choices they could have made. Like, what are you holding Darkseid back for?
It's like we've talked about, whether it's the first season of Inhumans or any of this, when you're planning on the sequel to the sequel to the sequel ahead of...
You may not get a chance.
Yeah, like ahead of what you need to do now. You know, if your goal, I don't know. Particularly, Pete, here's your bad guy. You mentioned it. I touched on it. It's already been in the comics. Reign of the Superman, which if you're not familiar with it, dear listeners, you know, Superman is dead and officially dead and all that. And because of story machinations I won't get into now, there's a clone done by Star Labs that is released early. So that becomes Superboy. That's one of the four Supermen. There's John Irons, I believe, who's a guy wearing a suit that becomes Steel. And then there's one that's like an automaton. And then there's one that's actually an evil cyborg. It's not the same cyborg as this, but he had Cyborg Superman. Point being, that's where your bad guy could have been. You could have had
all that's great. I would have completely been down for a bunch of Supermen, or even, I don't know whether it was teased out whether there was an image, whether there was a photo test or whatever, but this idea of like primordial Superman, like he was going to have a beard and long hair and they were going to have to clean him up and, you know, because of whatever regenerative powers, the dirty water in the middle of Metropolis in this crashed ship that they keep going back into has, I would have been down for that. Make him the villain. Do that. Commit to it. And here it's, well, we want a little of this and we want this other villain because we're going to get to Darkseid in three movies.
It would have been a better team-up movie if they were fighting against, whether it's confused real Superman or fake Superman who actually the evil cyborg has made a copy of the body or, you know, whatever it is. If it was them versus who they believe to be Superman, regardless of whether mentally, physically, it's him, etc., there would have been your motivation. I mean, surely the Flash looks up to, you know, as a younger person looks up to Superman. He's gonna say, I can't believe I'm fighting this guy. And Bruce Wayne, you know, fighting the man whose sacrifice he's come to appreciate, and so on and so forth. That could have been your route to the pathos. I mean, yeah. Pete, we just pitched a better movie.
We did, and when they have this throwdown, this abbreviated throwdown, after they've resurrected him in a convoluted explanation of, well, the box needs to just hit the magic dirty water to get him to revive.
With it electricity, happens. Pete. It needs to hit the dirty water with electricity.
It happens, and I think this is my biggest issue with the DC extended universe. It's the reaction to criticism. It's the reaction to fans. Keep your vision and move forward with your vision until you find acclamation, until you find adulation. People said we're too dark and we don't have jokes now, and now we're going to do jokes. It just feels like such a lack of direction. And now we're going to have this throwdown in the Memorial Park in Metropolis outside of the ship where there was a statue of Superman that is now in ruin, where there are names of the victims of the Battle of Metropolis from the Man of Steel film. And there is no one around, which is a direct reaction to the abject carnage that happened in that first film where the entire city is laid to waste. Also, strangely, not a lot of people seen there, but even fewer people, just cars, Matt, witnessed the throwdown between Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, The Flash, and Cyborg. And when I think they have a reporter in this universe, she shows up to stop it.
I enjoyed the emotional notion that the big weapon to deploy against Superman is, you know, the person who knows him best, the person,
yes,
who knows
but you
Superman.
You couldn't have her doing her thing, have the strength of a woman being a reporter and covering this fight, and then, wait, what's that control room? And then, boom, she's the secret weapon to come out of the car. Again, Matt, I just wrote that. We could massage that. It's already better.
Well, Pete, that would go great with another scene, which I saw, I think, on a preview or commercial or something, where we saw in the completed film her kind of tossing and turning and missing him. But there's a whole scene of him. I'm trying to think where I would have seen this because I'm adverse to spoilers, but there's a whole scene of him asking why she's still wearing the engagement ring or
yes,
which she's,
yeah,
hallucinating. So there's more Lois Lane stuff. And again, it's as you're saying, like, I enjoy Amy Adams. I enjoy Lois Lane in this movie. Amy Adams is not my Lois Lane. If that's my own fanboy baggage that I'm bringing to it, so be it.
Margot Kidder for life, son.
Yeah. I wasn't even particularly a fan of the one on Smallville, but bottom line is, if you're gonna let her be the surrogate for the audience, which is a great idea, because most of us are not billionaires. I mean, Pete, Fantastic Geek does have us have us rolling in the Patreon money, but we have yet to complete the Batcave. But again, I mean, none of us have these highest heights that these heroes do. Lois Lane could be the in, and we would totally be with her. The notion that a deceased loved one had suddenly come back, and you're seeing it in this hyper public way, you're seeing it on the news, or you're looking out the window, that's more emotionally fulfilling. But I guess that's part of what's lacking in this movie, is they were just going for like kind of, they were going for kind of the Hulkbuster aesthetic without any of the dramatic trappings.
I have stakes here, Matt, in that Chris Terrio co-wrote this with Zack Snyder, and Chris Terrio now has the great honor. He's going to be the third of four writers that have gone at Star Wars Episode IX with a massive issue in solving the Princess General Leia conundrum without using CGI or some kind of, oh, New Alderaan has blown up off screen between two movies, whatever. I hope he didn't do a lot of the character work in this, or I hope he understands Rey and Finn and Poe and Luke and Kylo and Snoke and all those a lot better going into that. And yeah, I know he's done great stuff before, but man, this from a character standpoint, when they introduce Superman as Clark Kent at the very end of Man of Steel, I groaned, because Clark Kent is baked into, as a reporter, Superman, and we need that, and we need that lens. And I think of anything Man of Steel got correct, it was Lois Lane, although that she needs to be in every action sequence as someone doing action rather than being a reporter, which, you know, having been a former full-time reporter, Lois Lane and Clark Kent as ideas are so close to my heart. I think of them, I teach Lois Lane as this is what you be as a reporter, and I can't show them Amy Adams. I can't do it.
Well, for whatever it's worth, Chris Terrio was really good at adapting things. He rewrote David S. Goyer's script for Batman v Superman. He has rewritten Ben Affleck's script for the untitled yet unmade Batman movie. He rewrote the true life story of Argo into his Oscar winning
script for Argo. That's the one. And listen, he's got an Oscar, and I'm going to have the faith in him to do that. But he did not pony it up here, man. This was not Oscar worthy writing. And again, it's a collaborative process. And I'm sure, and actually Whedon did get a credit, get a writing credit, but sometimes it's, you know, how many chefs in the kitchen and everything like that. Please, guys, learn to understand Lois Lane.
Well, Pete, let's quickly dip into kind of a potpourri segment here. Let's talk briefly. Much was made online of the Zack Snyder Amazonian metal bikinis versus the Patty Jenkins more reasonable version. I must admit, in the cut of the movie we saw, there were a couple metal bikinis here and there, but certainly I did not see fight scenes where the Amazonians were dressed inappropriate for battle. I, of course, Pete would never define what is appropriate or inappropriate for a woman to wear, you know, of her own volition. But for battle, I think we can all agree you want to cover your guts. And that's by and large what I saw, whether they were guarding the mother box or whichever box they had, were there three mother boxes, whatever box they were protecting, they all looked appropriately attired in the battle scenes. They looked fine. So to me, it was just maybe the wrong production still put against something from the other movie.
For me, there was no controversy. I did look for it. I did scan the participants, and you had the flashback recap of what happened with Steppenwolf before, when, you know,
which was really awesome, by the way.
it was decent. I can't say I was truly invested, and that's a failure of Steppenwolf as a threat.
You had the God Shazam, you had a Green Lantern, die and the ring go off to find its next most the next candidate. I mean, to me, that was just chock filled with stuff I was never super close to in DC, but it expanded my universe. It was a ton of fun.
It was decent. it was one of the better moments of the film, the villain lacking. But I did not think there was an issue with the Amazonian outfits. And I know that had been a thing in the last week, and then it kind of came back because it was like, listen, it's not contextualized. Understand what it is. And I think what came across on screen did that. So points for them there.
Pete, we are close to the city of New York. We go there for New York Comic Con. We go there for fun, et cetera, et cetera. We know the magic of those hot dog carts. We know the magic of the dirty water dogs. In this movie, we have Superman resurrected in that dirty water. Your thoughts there on the fact that this is now two movies in a row where the plot is made possible by dirty water?
I do not eat the dirty water dogs because they might smell intoxicating, but you get a couple of those belly bombers in there and the belly ache begins. I'm a grill, not a flat iron grill guy. I'm a do it over a charcoal or a propane grill type of guy. But yeah, can we stop returning to this wrecked Kryptonian ship that just has to be teeming with space bacteria and human bacteria and Lex Luthor DNA and all the other stuff at this point? To like, technically, doesn't Superman now have a little Luthor in him?
I mean, depending on how the dirty water plus the mother box plus the Kryptonian robots, maybe.
They submerged him in it, and then the electricity and all that. And I get it. You need something to jumpstart him, and it's there for the taking. But can we just electrify him and Cyborg stands over him and the thing? Like, why keep going back to it?
Well, you know what? We're back to Spider-Man 3, where they took – in Spider-Man 3, they took what had been this really protracted thing of there's the new suit and it's this alien cloth. And then I want to say for 8, 10, 12 issues, there were these little things to say, hey, something isn't right. And something isn't right. And hey, it's weird that Peter Parker just reached for Mary Jane and the suit, which could shoot web, the suit shot web at her, but Peter Parker didn't will it. Oh, I guess that was subconscious that I wanted her to stay here. No, something is wrong with the suit. You slowly start to figure out. In Spider-Man 3, it's deliver the suit, get the suit, suit is bad, suit is ripped off, suit is done with, all in one movie. If you had Reign of the Superman, Henry Cavill plays bad Superman, cyborg Superman, whatever it is, so you get him in there. Meanwhile, Pete, the body's gone. Pete, there's proof that somehow one of those Kryptonian robots took his body... from Kansas. How did it know? And it's taken it back to the Fortress of Solitude. Oh man.
All of these
things post-credit
are
scene?
Far more He's interesting back. Than anything I watched. Far more interesting. And it doesn't take a genius. It doesn't take a deep comic dive. It's not like you've got to go through every issue ever to come up with this stuff. And it just feels like they're aware that Superman has a cape and wears a thing on his chest and is clean cut. And that's about all they know of these characters. There's far better story possibilities still out there. I think that's where we leave these characters hopeful, but we're five movies into their universe and it's a soup sandwich.
Well, I mean, let's look ahead to the future then. There's a certain point if you graph the money made on these movies, Wonder Woman being an outlier, it's on the decline, particularly since Justice League should have done Wonder Woman plus Suicide Squad plus Batman v Superman money. Pete, what do you think is the future for this?
Well, we know what's on their slate to come, Matt. We know that there is an Aquaman movie that is in active moving to post-production.
Yeah, I think they wrapped in the last 3 weeks or so.
Okay, so we have that. And I will go see that. And you will go see that. And we are certainly interested in that. I want to see more of that character based on the glimpses that we have in this film. And that's effectively teased out here. I think you come away with that. But past that, I mean, what is next? Are they doing the bad guy team up one again? That's not the Suicide Squad, like the end scene here. Are they going to the Cyborg movie? The Flash thing is still in complete limbo. I know they moved Wonder Woman up a month in 2019. So it seems their future's really murky, but hey, Darkseid's out there. Or is he? I don't know. They don't know.
So Aquaman is scheduled to be released December 2018. Obviously 13 months from now. Shazam starts to film this upcoming February with a release date of April 2019. And then Wonder Woman
is November 2019.
Yeah, November 2019. So, I mean, if you want to call this that, with no disrespect to any of the characters, if you want to call it kind of this middle road of, it's a year where it's going to be Thor and Doctor Strange and Black Panther, where like, oh, I don't know, how interested are people in those characters? Side note, the first two of the three movies I just mentioned did really, really, really well. And I guarantee you that the box office return for Black Panther is going to be through the roof, because every 3 years, Hollywood discovers that if you make compelling a movie with compelling black characters, the African-American audience shows up in droves. And if it has crossover appeal, everybody goes to see it. So it's going to exceed expectations there. But point being,
it's going to make Black Panther will make more money in its opening weekend than everything the Warner Brothers threw at you in this movie. Let that sink in for a moment. 10 years ago,
you are correct. Easily. You are correct.
10 years ago, Matt, if I found you, because we didn't know each other yet, if I found you and said, hey, other dude, I don't know, but I know you might be into some geeky stuff, I'm going to throw you a question. The movie with Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, The Flash, Cyborg, and Aquaman versus a Black Panther movie, what makes more money its opening weekend? Anyone would have answered the Justice League.
Yeah.
No one would have answered Black Panther. And you can tweet at me in February when I'm correct. They will make more money in that opening weekend. And again, money's not the end all be all. And critically is where it's at as well. We haven't even touched, Matt, on the Rotten Tomato meter in this podcast yet. And the unprecedented move, in addition to an embargo. Okay, and just so the average listener understands, if you don't, when we review something that you're given early access to, it is done with the handshake agreement that you can talk about certain things until this. You can give a general reaction. You can't go into certain items. For instance, the return of Superman was off limits until a review could be published. And they gave the date for reviews, the embargo date, as Wednesday of this last week. Okay. And then Rotten Tomatoes held its tomato meter aggregate score of all those critics until the day of the previews, Thursday, until they revealed that number. And of course, the number wasn't good. But very, very concerning for transparency when it comes to reviews. And I know there are people saying, oh, I don't read reviews and I don't like people telling me how to think, and I love this movie. Great. I'm glad you loved it. Okay. But I think you're going to find there might be some level that you're convincing yourself that you liked it because it didn't suck. And that can't be the goal. These movies, these characters should be great when they appear. Not, oh, we got him out there and phew, we did it.
Amidst the entertainment press, there was a lot of notice taken, not just that Rotten Tomatoes was delaying its release of the score, but that Warner Brothers is a part owner of Rotten Tomatoes. Mm-hmm. Entertainment Weekly wondered if perhaps, at least, well, they didn't qualify it as within the kind of Hollywood blogosphere, but I will, that amidst the entertainment community, The thought being, did that do more damage with critics than was already there? The critics sharpened their knives even more because one of their own, ostensibly, or kind of the sharing of news, the sharing of reviews was a chunk was taken out by the delay of this. So I don't know what the answers are there, just that definitely there's a perception in Hollywood that advanced buzz is, if it's bad advanced buzz, that's bad for the movie, which I get. Nobody wants to plunk down taking your family to see a movie that's not good. But when was the embargo lifted for Thor? 3 weeks before the movie came out, and there were all these reviews saying, best reviewed Marvel movie ever, which, I mean, I guess you know whether you have a hit or a miss, you know well in advance of when you hand it over to the critics. But people are going to get wise to, hey, movie X, there's been commercials with reviews for 3 weeks. Movie Y that I'm also interested in, I haven't heard anything about that. Let me go look online. Oh, there's nothing about it. That's now code for a stinker.
Yeah, and again, not what people wanted to hear going into this, that only increases this air of, something's just not right. And by the time, Matt, we're in the CGI fest climax with a complete lack of stakes, I mean, thank goodness the most important and possibly only family in not Chernobyl, Russia, got out.
Yeah, it was not clear to me, A, why that was headquarters for Steppenwolf. I thought at first it's because that's where the powers of man had buried the third box, and that wasn't the case. And it was like, why are they there? And then why has it taken so long for these creatures to kind of get in through boarded up windows? And why are they there? And once Steppenwolf shows up, I'm still not clear why they're there. And the whole thing was kind of very muddy. And then if you want to say they're the only family, fine. But then you get the yuck of Flash saves them, and they're the proxy for the audience and whatnot. But Superman has just saved a building full of people. Well, what about their story?
Maybe people. We don't see any people.
Because we can't see too many people.
How about, thanks, Superman, and a wave. That's all it takes. We're not talking about massive, massive reshoots. We're talking about little additions here and there to do it. I mean, that they went and got the permission to use the John Williams Superman cue a couple times this film, that they went and got the Danny Elfman Batman cue to use in this film. It only felt apologetic, given that they had already established their own themes. Again, stand your ground, find success on your own instead of course correcting back to that old success.
Yeah, it was something. And then Pete, you know, the good guys and good gal saved the day. A little leftover for next time. We have two post-credit scenes. Let me say right off the bat, I guess, good job to DC and Warner Brothers for pulling from the Marvel formula for post-credit scenes. Here's the problem. I don't like that formula. Doing a funny halfway through and a see you next time at the end, I feel like it's played out. I said that for Thor. I think it's true across the board. They need to be doing something different, even if it's just a low level, you know, funny on the way out, i.e. Tony Stark is talking to Bruce Banner, and I'm not a therapist. Like, I'd rather have that versus, oh man, here's some you know, here's a snack for next time. But anyhow, we get that formula here. First off, Pete, evocative of the, you know, fastest man alive stuff from DC, we get the race,
I guess. I got to be honest, Matt. I know I didn't pay attention to a lot of this. And I know your attention was defrayed from this.
We had somebody sitting in front of us, although not directly, just because of the where we sit in the theater, who she was on her phone for most of it, with her big giant hair, and then she'd get up and give her walk across to another part of the theater where her kids were and give them snacks and come back and not sit down. And that was all just another slow nail in the coffin of one day Pete will just pony up the $50 to get this off of, you know, Movie Tunes or whatever the anti-iTunes thing will be. And we'll just, you know, say, oh, we're paying more than we used to, but at least we don't have Lady Who Won't Sit Down and who's on her phone the entire time.
That to me was that episode was emblematic of this film. So you had a woman directly in front of us, and we were set back a little further in a row of three that we like to reserve, and then it's always who's the mystery guest going to be. And this time it was well, talk about the ones we've had before, Matt, and then I'll explain this guy.
Right. So these seats, we go to a theater where you can select your own seats and where it's, you know, they're comfy chairs and they recline and all that. And we had chosen for Logan, we had chosen back right corner where you're elevated a bit. You're also, just because of the virtue of how they've used it and how where you're sitting relative to the way out, you're kind of by yourself, these three seats. So we call them the Logan seats. The first time we did it, there was nobody next to us. The movie had already begun. And then this lady who was of a great grandmotherly age sat down as Logan is stabbing people and chopping heads off and F this and S that. So that was old lady Logan or Loga, whatever you want to call her. Let's see, for Guardians of the Galaxy 2, the guy sits down and goes, I don't remember the exact quote, Pete. I'm sure you remember the quote.
Reflect on my reportorial training. The guy leans over to Matt and by extension myself and deadpans, I want you to know I have a condition where when I see aliens in a movie, I yell uncontrollably, and it's up to the person next to me to snap me back into reality. And I said, well, it's a good thing you got this guy next to you, because I'm incapable of performing that duty. And,
so, yeah.
And then for this film, Matt, we got guy who laughs too loud at jokes that are not meant to be laughed loudly at.
Yeah, I'd say he might have laughed 8 times, and 6 to 7 of those times, no one else in the entire theater was laughing.
The old, I have acknowledged you have just told a joke. I mean, yeah. he might have been a Warner Brothers shill for all we know. But he got up during the movie when that woman had her phone on, and there was another woman, another woman. I don't know the gender of the other person that had their phone on further over after the aisle in that row. That to me was emblematic of this film. You're in a great movie, you're not checking your phone. It doesn't happen. You don't check your watch, whatever it's going to be. You are pulled in by the narrative. You don't want it to end. And people here were distracted almost from the word go. A little kid, Matt, that a little kid is coming over to get snacks from his mom who's sitting in a different part of the theater. Let's not even address that problem. But I'm worried about my belly. I'm not worried about the Superman on screen. Okay. I have been in movies where I didn't want to move for fear of missing anything. And I know that there was some kind of race, and I saw Flash light a firecracker, and then I saw slow motion zoom me away. And that's about, I think that's what I was supposed to get there.
Yeah. I mean, essentially it was them. To me, I thought it was a good echo from one of the highlights of the evil Superman fight scene, where Flash is going to come in and save the day because he's faster than everybody else. And then Superman is able to see him in real time as Flash is at super time, you know. Yeah. Superman is able to see it just as quickly and so on and so forth. So they're going to settle things here with this race to see who the fastest person is. And this is a throwback to the comics. I thought it was endearing. But then, Pete, we get somebody who I was pleasantly surprised to see Lex Luthor, given as how word was his number of scenes from this movie were cut. And he's escaped from prison. He's on a boat. And Pete, who's there? Who's there to tickle our fancies?
Well, it's implied that Deathstroke, and you can tell it the moment you see the swords on the speedboat heading out to the much larger boat, has had a hand in freeing Lex Luthor and putting him on the boat here. Lex Luthor, who was cut from the body of this film, to be in the post-credit scene and set up some kind of not Justice League of bad people. And okay, Deathstroke has been announced as a film, and The Batman is in pre-production, where Joe Manganiello's Slade Wilson is going to appear. But I thought it was better than the other scene, but I mentioned it to you as we're watching the credits. Jeremy Irons' Alfred in one of the trailers, there's footage of someone showing up, and there's a green reflection from whoever is on the other side of the camera, and Alfred says, "They told me," or "He told me you show up." And is there somehow a Green Lantern reveal? Maybe they could get that right. I mean, from the limited glimpse that we saw, it definitely seemed like Green Lantern was done a little bit better than the last time that happened. But it doesn't show up here. And again, I think we left the best parts out of this movie.
A couple of thoughts tied to other movies. First of all, whatever the sins are of this movie, I felt comfortably entertained the entire time. Like, at no point was I bored. There might have been moments of rolling my eyes, but I felt the pacing was good. And if they cut another half hour of, even if it was reflection of Lois Lane tossing and turning, and then tossing and turning some more, and then blurry cut to Dreamland, and then she sees him, and then cut back to her, wake up, like, the pace was good. This as the Three Ring Circus, I felt that I didn't get ants in my pants and I wasn't trying to get out of my seat. Unlike the Green Lantern movie, which is horrendously awful. So there's that as perspective there. I mean, to me, that is one of the worst movies I've ever seen. Just nonsense. Connected indirectly to Green Lantern, Ryan Reynolds, Deadpool. And I'm looking at the quote right here that when Deadpool was first created, by the artist, he showed it to the writer, or vice versa. The comment is about Deadpool was, "This is Deathstroke from Teen Titans." Right. I mention this because there's this weird moment where I saw the katanas and I'm like, wait, Deadpool? No, wait, what? What? And I'm familiar with Deathstroke the Terminator. Here's my only concern, Pete. If Deadpool is, shall we say, liberally similar to the to Deathstroke, which Deathstroke being the original character, who made the decision, regardless of who came first, Deathstroke looks like Deadpool. That's how it is now in the pop culture, with Deadpool that did $700 million dollars and had a preview attached to this movie. The Bob Ross thing was cleaned up. I don't know whether that was fully attached to the movie or just one of these things that, like, AMC does. But point is, how many people were disappointed that it was going to be Deadpool, but it wasn't, because they don't know the two sides and whatever. And now we're thinking DC has ripped off Deadpool.
Yeah.
Where was that discussion from your leadership?
I like Deathstroke, and I knew Deathstroke before Deadpool, courtesy the Injustice video game, and he's my main, he's my guy that I beat people up as. And I like the Slade character, and maybe you could have introduced him with the helmet off and kept it off, and then have him put the helmet on or something like that rather than take it off. But I get the reveal. I understand it. This was not to buttress your future slate, when we don't even know, are we going to get another Suicide Squad? Are we going to get a Legion of Doom movie? What are we going to do? Again, man, there just seems a basic lack of direction, and let's do something because it's cool, not because this is going to get people excited.
Well, Pete, let's talk about the people. I sent out a poll on Twitter. The options were, what did you think of the movie? The options were, you could vote and or reply. The four categories: super, man. Next was met my high expectations. Next was met my low expectations. Last was reboot the DCEU like now, which you think we're kidding about. In my opinion, they're one or two money-losing movies away from Flashpoint, and oh man, now all of a sudden Batman looks different, and all of a sudden this and that the other. But
people, listen, that they have already floated Jake Gyllenhaal as the Batman post Flashpoint, and I'm willing to bet that's going to happen, and only Gal Gadot and maybe Cavill survive that as far as the mains. Tells you everything you need to know. They're in a situation where they're just not making good decisions. And I think the results of our poll, Matt, tell you where we are.
Yeah, 19% said Superman, 16% said met my high expectations, 41% said met my low expectations, and 24% calling for a reboot. We also got some responses. First was from our pal at JJ Nato, who said they fixed DCEU Superman. Steppenwolf was terrible, but at least they didn't spend a lot of time with him. Godot and Superman were wonderful. That one nerd Ron, that's at Raspires8, said, how about them credit sequences? At Kowtow Zero, that's Kowtow with a K, said, shh, do you hear that? What's that sound? I think, yep, it's Kevin Feige, I'll change his wording here, weeing his pants laughing. Tom Shy at TJ Shy, S-H-I-E, said, liked it until the second post-credit scene, disliked the portrayal of a character by a certain actor. So I don't know which one he's talking about, but certain, I mean, Deathstroke was in the Arrowverse shows.
Yes.
Is that what it is? Is Tom a big... You know,
I think he's talking about Luther there.
Really? Okay.
I think he is.
If so, that's okay. I dug Luther by the end of Batman v Superman. But I didn't, you know, but I mean, again, we're back to there are better presentations of these characters.
Let's hope in the Flashpoint they get it correct and Bryan Cranston becomes their Lex Luthor.
It would be interesting to do that level, to do a universe. Nobody's done a universe reboot, certainly to this degree.
And it could. It's unique to this type of storytelling. And the precedent exists, albeit not at this level. But you know what? Again, go bold rather than 65% of the people in this poll responding that it was low or needs to be rebooted. Okay. To the point where people are just dissatisfied with the product that's turned out. So go bold with it, have a vision. This is what we're going to do and move forward with the courage of your convictions rather than, oh, they didn't like it. So now we've got to do this and have jokes.
For whatever it's worth, back when Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone came out, all the way back in 2001, which, side note, I would not have thought that it was November 2001. I feel like movie must have done something to transport all of us who saw it just mentally from 9/11 and all that, because I wouldn't have said even same year. That had a $90 million opening weekend, and that was a huge deal. Now, granted, different, you know, you want to say apples and oranges, fine. I just want to point out that's 16 years ago, and without inflation, the roller coaster that was Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone grossed within a couple million dollars of what this movie did. So not a good
place. They're not getting out of the property what they need to. And I think, again, the Hollywood press is going to be covering this pretty furiously with the disappointing result. And again, I gave you the Black Panther example. I'll give you this. I find you 10 years ago, Matt, and I say, okay, movie with Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman does more in its first weekend than just the Wonder Woman movie. Which one is it? And again, you would have gone with the latter. Okay. And the strength of that character, and with all the reshoots, they still couldn't play her up more than they did. They can't even identify what their strengths are.
However, Pete, they did have time, and this isn't even on our notes, they did have time to float the non-possibility of Bruce Wayne having feelings for her, which to me was out of left field. Just like just with all this going on in terms of harassment and workplace and all of that, it tonally struck me as a bit off. Now, did they make most of this movie before all these PR crises and all these true stories came to light? Sure. So I'm not going to hit them too hard on that. But to me, it was just weird. Like, can't Batman and Wonder Woman form a team without, you know, Batman's surrogate dad and Alfred asking him, do you like her? Like,
right. Right. I it was one of the cuter lines, the idea that Alfred was going to bring her a note, you know, check yes or no. And Jeremy Irons certainly saved that one. To me, the moment at the end of the film when they go back into the Wayne Mansion and the idea that they're going to turn that into the Justice League headquarters with six chairs and room for more, that's hope. But I don't believe many of the people that we currently see in here are ultimately going to be sitting in those six chairs and maybe more. And I think if they're going to do it right, there have to be different people.
Time certainly will tell, Pete. And of course, we'll be there. We'll be there seeing it. We'll be there podcasting it. And we know that this Justice League review was eagerly anticipated by more than a few of our listeners, particularly some of our pals from patreon.com/fantasticgeek. So we have gone through the gauntlet for you.
Yeah, we have our own Justice League of listeners, of contributors. So everybody who goes to patreon.com/fantasticgeek and contributes at any level gets exclusive podcast content. And then there are all sorts of levels. Do you want to lead the Fantastic Geek Justice League? Well, you could give it that level. And they're going to unlock other perks, like how close you get to sit to Matt and all things like that when we record. But we're super thankful for our heroes.
Indeed we are, Pete, and particularly this busy time of year where it's Marvel, it's DC, it's Star Wars, it's a lot to juggle, but it's with the knowledge that we have these listeners counting on us, whether they're Patreon or not, but the Patreon people are the ones where you go, okay, Pete, you know what? Justice League today, Punisher tomorrow, Runaways on Tuesday, and then, you know, something on Wednesday. Maybe we won't record on Thanksgiving, but then we'll figure something else out.
Whenever I feel sluggish, Matt always texts me the name of an individual patron. And I'm like, that I have a name now. I have somebody's identity in mind who needs us to do this. So that's our driving force here. All of you listeners, certainly something that we always think about and we want to represent. We are you.
Pete, how can those other people who are also us as part of the collective you, how can they be in touch with the singular you?
You can find me on Twitter at Peter, P-I-E-T-E-R-J, Ketelaar, K-E-T-E-L-A-A-R, 9,630 followers. Can't be wrong.
And while I am personally on Twitter as Looking Back Lost, you can be in touch with the podcast anytime you want. We are Fantastic Geek. Visit FantasticGeek.com. Email FantasticGeek@gmail.com. Check out Fantastic Geek on Twitter and Instagram as well. But wait, Pete, there's more.
Facebook.com/FantasticGeek with the PH, all one word, like it today.
Well, Pete, we will be back on the Pop Culture Podcast with Punisher tomorrow, Runaways on Tuesday, and then probably a combination of those two as frantically as possible till we get to Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. in December, and then definitely Punisher and Runaways done before Star Trek Discovery returns January 7th. It's a great time to be doing this. Oh, also some family events where we're going to, you know, celebrate Thanksgiving and Christmas and New Year's and whatnot.
It's the most wonderful time of the year.
Pete, I have nothing left to say about Justice League, so I give you the final word.
There are heroes among us, not to make us feel smaller, but to remind us of what makes us great.